Today with Claire Byrne on RTE Radio 1, sponsored by Cash and Carry Kitchens, at the heart of Irish homes for over 40 years. Cashandcarrykitchens.ie.
Email todaycb at rte.ie.
51551 is the number people have been texting to let their feelings be known on closing schools for voting. Let's bring you some of them. Mary in Terran, your voting on the weekend is a simple solution. Another one, an audit of polling stations should be carried out to identify alternatives to schools. Thanks for raising this issue. Paul is voting in his local GAA club. God knows there's hundreds of them in the country. It's not just working mothers and parents. I'm a stay-at-home mother who also cares for my sick mother. I'm also concerned that my children are missing important days of education too. The school year is short enough. And she goes on to say teachers are happy to take the day off. Well, they have no choice in it, to be fair. I mean, the school is closed and they don't have a say in it. I'm not a parent of primary school children, but I volunteer with children who have special needs, and closing the schools puts an enormous burden on parents. This is Michael. Why can't we have voting on a Saturday or Sunday like most European countries? Look at the amount of vacant office space around our cities and counties. Why can't these be used as polling stations instead of schools? And this one, while I don't particularly agree with using schools as polling stations, neither are our schools a babysitting service. And Sinead Brady, who was on earlier talking about this, said it's not about the fact that the children aren't being looked after by the school. It's about the education that they're missing out on. School is not childcare. The election wasn't last minute. We were notified months ago. Elections are every 5 years. Polling stations in schools are not an issue. Schools are an ideal location and are very accessible both in rural and urban areas. And the texts are still flying in. I'll bring you one more before we move on. Our school took an extended June weekend as a quasi-half term because Easter was so early this year. My children, who are 6 and 9, had a 4-day week, a 5-day weekend, now a 2-day week. Safe to say education is out the window until at least next Monday. Keep them coming in, 51551. Now, moving on, in what has been described as a massive step forward by researchers, a major cause of inflammatory bowel disease, or IBD, has been discovered. This breakthrough came as researchers discovered a part of DNA only active in some immune cells, which can cause inflammation in the bowels. Well, to discuss and I hope explain all of this, I'm joined on the line by Professor Humphrey O'Connor, consultant gastroenterologist. Humphrey, good morning to you.
Morning, Claire. Nice to talk to you.
Now, this sounds very complex, but the bottom line is it's really good news, is it, for people who are living with things like Crohn's disease, ulcerative colitis?
Yeah, it certainly is, Claire. I mean, if you, the study comes from the laboratory called the Genetic Mechanisms of Disease Laboratory in the Crick Institute in London. And what James Lee and his colleagues have found that in one particular part of the genome, on chromosome 21, there's a little patch that seems to be able to enhance the activity of a particular gene, which in turn affects an inflammatory or an immune cell called the macrophage. The macrophage is part of our immune system. It's in all the tissues in the body. And that cell appropriately responds in a way to infection, where it gobbles up the bacterium, disposes of dead cells, and pours out proteins, cytokines, that recruit other parts of the immune system. So that's appropriate if you and I got an infection. Mm-hmm. Situation here is that our colleagues in London have seen from their research, and it's very good, it's high science there, this enhancer in that part of the chromosome that drives this gene, ETS2, to then drive the macrophage to inappropriately pour out, do what it should do to create inflammation in situations where it's not appropriate. And this is the type, that is the scenario that faces people with inflammatory bowel disease. They have a chronic inflammatory process in their gut of unknown cause. They didn't get it for any reason. And it keeps remitting, relapsing as they go through life.
A lifelong condition in many cases, Humphrey, with no cure.
Absolutely. I think that, I mean, I don't mean to sound depressing, but I think that summed it up. I mean, treatments have evolved. If you were to go back 20 years, say, that was the beginning of the development of agents that selectively knocked out some of those cytokines, those inflammatory proteins. And that is the, so the last 20 years, we've seen the development of 5, 6, 7 of those, and patients have been treated very effectively mm-hmm. with those agents. But we're treating the inflammation without quite knowing what's driving it in the first place.
So what this might be leading us to, this discovery, is that fact that this immune response now, which has been discovered, that might be treated with medication at source rather than treating what it causes.
Yeah, that is true. I mean, as James Lee says, they've uncovered a pathway. It might be overstating it to say we have a new cure for those lifelong conditions. I don't mean to be pessimistic in any way, but that pathway might allow, for instance, the development of medication further back along the line, and that, again, might be more effective in controlling the inflammation. Mm-hmm. But the catch is like this. We need our macrophages to protect us against infection and other insults. It's part of our innate immune system. Our colleagues in London say don't switch off that gene, they just reduce its activity, because it's a trade-off. You can imagine that if you stop the macrophage working, then a whole load of useful cytokines that it produces are not produced.
So you have to balance this then.
Absolutely. I mean, and that in clinical terms, when you're sitting with a patient talking about their treatment, the debate is about risk and benefit. This is not in any way to diminish what our colleagues in London have done, which is terrific, and it really gives insight into what might underlie some of what's happening to drive the inflammation in Crohn's or ulcerative colitis.
So this description then of this discovery as being a massive uh-huh. step forward, do you agree that that's what it is?
I think it's a step forward. Yes, I think it's very important. It's very important because it takes you back to that. I mean, there are lots of other environmental, familial factors and so on that are there in the mix as potential causes of inflammatory bowel disease. But perhaps you're born with some slight genetic defect in that particular part of that chromosome. It's a very small bit. Mm-hmm. And having that and go on to do other things, your diet isn't right, or you're smoking strongly linked with Crohn's. Curiously, non-smoking is linked with ulcerative colitis. So I think we have to put genetic, immune, environmental factors together. But this unknown piece of the jigsaw is important, Claire, in terms of what will happen.
And you and I have spoken on this programme before about the fact that cases of IBD, irritable bowel disease, they're becoming more common. And why is that the case? Do we know?
Well, I mean, if you look in this country, we have at least 40,000 people living with inflammatory bowel disease. Worldwide, 4.9 million. USA is the highest. And it's increasing. And when we've talked in the past about if a disease is changing quickly, it's not genetics. It's much more likely to be environmental factors that are driving that change.
Diet.
Diet. I mean, when you think of your gut, you have to equate it with diet. But again, the ideal diet has not been worked out. One of the suppositions at the moment is that a diet a la the Mediterranean diet might be more helpful. Mm-hmm. Exercise. I don't mean to be vague, Claire, but we're not as hot as we should be in terms of understanding the dietary items, and then the microbiome in the gut. And the bacterial factors that that produces. That
oh, well, that's really interesting, Humphrey, because we were talking about this, the hygiene hypothesis on the programme in the last few days, and about the fact that we're perhaps not exposed as much as we were in childhood to infections. Is that playing a role?
In the increase in both autoimmune diseases, such as Crohn's or ulcerative colitis, or allergic disorders, that hypothesis suggests that in the absence of childhood exposure to childhood infection and dirt and all the rest of it, that the immune system doesn't develop in a tolerant way. There's a balance between the different cytokines or lymphocytes that are there. In the absence of childhood infection, so-called TH2, helper 2 cells, which produce allergic products, become dominant. And it may set the scene for increased risk of autoimmune disease or allergic disorders later in life.
Mm-hmm.
But admittedly not, though, when you think of the age groups, take Crohn's, for instance, slight female preponderance, age between 15 and 35, and that's affecting people when they're at their really best. And so and you're looking forward to a lifelong illness in that way. So other things happen, I think, to if you like, trigger the condition. But the findings by our colleagues of that genetic defect adds another little important piece of information. I mean, it also brings you back to, well, will we develop a medication, an anti-inflammatory, that will be targeted enough to just knock out that gene that's driving on the macrophage to do those daft things, and do it safely? And we'll still come back there until we find the ultimate cause of these conditions, when we use medications that suppress the immune system in any way, to this debate of safety, safety, safety.
Right. Well, you know, I mean, you talk about whether this might lead to some sort of a medical treatment intervention, but because mm-hmm. the mm-hmm. causes, as you have explained there, environmental and familial, I mean, you may still get symptoms of IBD, even if there is a medical development from this discovery. Am I right?
The patients respond to agents in unpredictable ways. Some respond to the biological agents we have at the moment. Some patients don't. Some patients, as they go through 3 or 5 years of treatment with a particular agent, lose response for reasons we don't quite understand. So we are we're going not it's not from one to the other, but we're still looking for the holy grail in terms of the treatment that will shut it down completely.
Now, there was another headline I wanted to ask you about today, which suggested that Ozempic, the weight loss drug, that those weight loss injections could reduce the risk of bowel cancer by half, based on other research that has been conducted. Now, I don't know if you've had a chance to have a look at that.
I had a look at what was referred to. And I think the common denominator there in relation to the reduction in bowel cancer again comes back to the environmental factor of obesity and type 2 diabetes. If you look at the epidemiology of colon cancer, which is a very common cancer and needs a lot of attention, both type 2 diabetes and obesity are risk factors as we go through life for colon cancer. And the 15-year study of the weight loss drug Ozempic, the study dealt with patients with type 2 diabetes, and people say that, well, type 2 diabetes has some form of a pro-inflammatory effect that increases the risk of colon cancer. But I think the common denominator, the environmental factor that ties the two things together, is the actual weight loss. But don't ask me to understand why the weight loss per se might reduce the risk of bowel cancer in itself. It must be at a cellular level in the lining of the bowel, perhaps again, diet changes and the impact they might have on the microbiome. So it's not one thing. I think you have to think of these conditions like a Venn diagram.
There's
a number of things together.
So weight loss might lead to the reduction in the bowel cancer risk. It doesn't matter whether you're taking an Ozempic injection or not. It doesn't matter how you do it.
I think it's fair to say that. I think I'd have to look at the literature as to whether what you've just said, whether weight loss per se is the one and only factor responsible for that reduction.
All right. It's
great to see it.
It's
great to see it, and I suppose it mirrors also the information coming through in terms of the reduction in cardiovascular risk with weight reduction and those medications. I'm not pushing them in any way, but simply, what's the message? Yeah, it's weight. It's central obesity. Try and get rid of it.
All right. Well, that's our takeaway. Humphrey, thank you so much. Professor Humphrey O'Connor there, who is a consultant gastroenterologist. And the messages are still coming in about the school closures for voting tomorrow. I'll just bring you one more before we take a break. It's not important that the children... Is it not important that the children learn that they are part of this very significant democratic process? They may well enjoy the day off. That's entirely appropriate. I can guarantee you they'll enjoy the day off. The topic can be explored at home and at school. It's very worthwhile. The children are part of it. 51551.
Text 51551 today with Claire Byrne on RTE Radio 1.